Text B. Mum's first attempt at matchmaking ended in dismal failure. People say as a woman approaches middle age, she interests herself in young people's love affairs and likes matchmaking. If this is true, I hope this first failure would discourage Mum from acquiring such an interest. I really don't know why she should have gone to such lengths to try and bring those two young people together. It was a fruitless and thankless job, doomed from the start because both parties put impossible demands on the opposite side. The man, Xiao Liu, is about 30 and works in Mum's office, apparently a very promising young man with an MA degree. Because he is very choosy, he has never been able to find a wife and is beginning to get worried as he will soon be over 30. The girl works in Dad's office and is 28. She is also a college graduate and very good at her work. She is quite pretty and has a very strong character. She too has not been able to find a husband because she is too choosy. Mum had thought innocently that however choosy they might have been, they would surely be satisfied this time. So she invited them over to meet in our house. She even went to the trouble of cooking them a delicious dinner. But Mum's pains were not rewarded. I don't know how they appreciated Mum's dinner, but they certainly didn't appreciate each other. Xiao Wu could only meet two of Xiao Yu's numerous demands. She is pretty, and she has a college degree. But besides that, he also wants the girl to be under 25, to be gentle and docile, a perfect housewife. He thought Xiao Wu had too strong a character, and that he wouldn't be able to control her. On the other hand, he fared even worse in Xiao Wu's eyes, having met only one of her demands. He is a postgraduate student, which is one of her prerequisites for a future husband, and this seems to be the only thing in his favour. She wants her future husband to be an overseas Chinese, or at least to have relatives overseas, so that she could go abroad some day. Also, she wants the man to be around 1.75 metres in height, and Xiao Liu is only 1.68 metres. I've heard people say that nowadays girls consider any young man under 1.7 metres as a semi-handicapped. Thank God, I'm already 1.73 metres, and with any luck I can grow another 5 centimetres. A most respectable height. But I don't have any relatives abroad, though. Mum was most annoyed, and put all the blame on the girl. What more does she want? She should realise that she's already 28 and she'll never find such an eligible young man again. Mum never mentioned a word about Xiao Liu's own objections. Who told you to help such an arrogant young man? Xiao Wu is 100 times better than he is. Any sensible young man would have jumped at the chance. Jump at the chance? I bet you wish you could jump at the chance yourself. Dad didn't know whether to laugh or to be angry. Additional information. A 50-year-old woman could not help crying when she heard a story, written by her husband, over the radio, recalling the early days of their marriage. The story by Shen Lijun, a senior lecturer at the Changsha Commercial School in this capital of Hunan Province, depicted how he, then a college graduate, met and married his wife, Long Hui Lan, when he was labelled a right-winger and forced to work in a neighbourhood factory in the 1960s. Shen said, "In those days, I dared not fall in love with any girls because of my inferior political status, and married the first girl who was willing." The couple confessed they did have differences of interests. After Shen became a lecturer, most of his visitors were intellectuals, Long said. After serving them a cup of tea, I had nothing to say and sat aside. Because of their cultural background, I could not get a word in edgeways during the chats. By and by, I came to see a gap between us. According to Shen, he and his wife also had different ways to teach their children. I did not like the way she treated our children, spoiling them and then beating them if they did not study well or listen to her. But whenever I came across contradictions with my wife in daily life, Shen explained, I like to recall those days of hardship we shared together, and this has become a spiritual support to us. Shen is a typical example among the middle-aged people in China, an official of the Changsha City Radio said. The radio has opened a special program to help middle-aged couples deepen their love by reviewing the past and exchanging experiences. The program has become popular with listeners and has received hundreds of letters from people from all walks of life. He Yingcai, a judge of the Hunan Provincial Higher People's Court, said middle-aged couples account for one-third of those married in the province. Traditionally, The marriage of young people was arranged by their parents, and couples paid more attention to each other's family background and political affiliation than their own feelings. As a result, many couples have no feelings for each other, though they have been married for years. According to statistics, about one quarter of the 27,000 couples divorced last year were middle-aged. Rong Xuqin, an official of the Hunan Provincial Women's Federation, said although the divorce rate among middle-aged people is lower than among people of other ages, this does not mean that their family lives are harmonious. For the sake of their children, many people try to make the best of it. It is our duty to help them form harmonious families because social stability depends on the stability of families, she said. Tang Xiyun, a sociologist specializing in marriage and women, noted that Chinese families may not be formed on the basis of feelings, but feelings for each other are the key to stabilizing a family. Lesson 29. The Voices of Time. Text A. Time talks. It speaks more plainly than words. Time communicates in many ways. Consider the different parts of the day, for example. The time of the day when something is done can give a special meaning to the event. Factory managers in the United States fully realize the importance of an announcement made during the middle of the morning or afternoon that takes everyone away from his work. Whenever they want to make an important announcement, they ask, "When shall we let them know?" In the United States, it is not customary to telephone someone very early in the morning. If you telephone him early in the day, while he is shaving or having breakfast, the time of the call shows that the matter is very important and requires immediate attention. The same meaning is attached to telephone calls after 11 p.m. If someone receives a call during sleeping hours, he assumes it is a matter of life or death. The time chosen for the call communicates its importance. In social life, time plays a very important part. In the United States, guests tend to feel they are not highly regarded if the invitation to a dinner party is extended only 3 or 4 days before the party date. But this is not true in all countries. In other areas of the world, it may be considered foolish to make an appointment too far in advance, because plans which are made for a date more than a week away tend to be forgotten. The meanings of time differ in different parts of the world. Thus, misunderstandings arise between people from cultures that treat time differently. Promptness is valued highly in American life, for example. If people are not prompt, they may be regarded as impolite or not fully responsible. In the U.S., no one would think of keeping a business associate waiting for an hour. It would be too impolite. When equals meet, a person who is 5 minutes late will say a few words of explanation, though perhaps he may not complete the sentence. Americans look ahead and are concerned almost entirely with the future. The American idea of the future is limited, however. It is the foreseeable future and not the future of the South Asian, which may involve centuries. Someone has said of the South Asian idea of time, "Time is like a museum with endless halls and rooms. You, the viewer, are walking through the museum in the dark, holding a light to each scene as you pass it. God is in charge of the museum, and only He knows all that is in it. One lifetime represents one room." Since time has such different meanings in different cultures, communication is often difficult. We will understand each other a little better if we can keep this fact in mind. Text B. I am a member of a small, nearly extinct minority group who insist, even though it seems to be out of date, on the sanctity of being on time. Which is to say that we on-timers are compulsively, unfashionably prompt, that there are only handfuls of us left, and, unfortunately, we never seem to have appointments with each other. The fact is that being on time has become a social mistake. The fact is that, generally speaking, the time that the late people set as the moment of rendezvous is a code. It is a code meaning at least 1/2 hour later. The fact is that we on-timers can't get that into our heads. We arrive invariably at the appointed hour at people's houses, which means that we have occasionally eaten all the sandwiches before the other guests arrive, which means that we are rude. Let me explain. We are, for example, invited for dinner at 8 o'clock at the home of friends who live exactly 20 minutes away. We leave our house at 7:50, so that for once we will be a comfortable 10 minutes late. Then even the traffic defeats us. We meet only green lights and arrive at 7:58. We drive about for a while and then enter at 7:01, to the astonishment of the host and hostess. She is at an important stage of preparation with the saucepans. He is thinking about taking a shower. We end up helping with the first course and putting the baby to bed and mixing the drinks, and are still left with enough time to analyze what kind of people our hosts are from the magazines on the coffee table. As for meeting in restaurants, you can immediately recognize us on-timers. We are the only non-alcoholics standing in restaurant doorways in December. If not, we can always be found killing time in the cloakroom or trying to look as if we are not alone at the bar. Now, we all know that these very same late people do not routinely miss planes or the beginnings of films. But, as I told a late person recently, if I were a train, I'd be gone. With regard to meetings, there are two kinds of people. Those who hate to wait, and those who hate to make others wait. The sadists and the masochists? I hope not. There was a New York magazine piece once about the power struggle involved in business lunches. It intimated that you could always tell the powerless and the powerful. The Indians were waiting, while the chiefs arrived 1/2 hour or 1 hour later. If you are an on-timer, you cannot make an entrance. The late people, of course, are always terribly sorry, but something important came up, in contrast to us, for instance. Besides, as they say, their minds are always so full of big questions, like the bomb, that they never know what time it is. In comparison with the on-timers, they suggest, who have their little brains filled with stupid details like the big hand and the little hand on the clock. The problem is getting worse. If you adjust to the late people and accept the fact that they're 1/2 hour behind the time you arrange to meet, they arrive 1 hour late. Fewer and fewer of us on-timers remain. We are now surprised when anyone else is on time. We have begun to make certain adjustments, like setting our clocks and watches back or bringing the novel we're working on to dinner parties. How late we are to recognize that being on time is out of date, that in fact, our time has passed. Additional information. How Americans see time. Americans recognize that there is a past on which the present rests, but they have not developed their sense of the depth of time to the extent that this has been done in the Middle East and South Asia. The Arabs look back 2,000 to 6,000 years for their own origins. History is used as the basis for almost any modern action. The chances are that an Arab won't start a talk or a speech or analyze a problem without first developing the historical aspects of his subject. The American assumes that time has depth, but he takes this for granted. The American never questions the fact that time should be planned and future events fitted into a schedule. He thinks that people should look forward to the future and not dwell too much on the past. His future is not very far ahead of him. Results must be obtained in the foreseeable future, 1 or 2 years, or, at the most, 5 or 10. Promises to meet deadlines and appointments are taken very seriously. There are real penalties for being late and for not keeping commitments in time. The American thinks it is natural to quantify time. To fail to do so is unthinkable. The American specifies how much time is required to do everything. I'll be there in 10 minutes. It will take 6 months to finish that job. I was in the army for 4.5 years. The Americans, like so many other people, also use time as a link that chains events together. If one event occurs on the heels of another, we inevitably try to find a causal relationship between them. If A is seen in the vicinity of B's murder shortly after the crime has been committed, we automatically form a connection between A and B. Conversely, Events which are separated by too much time are difficult for us to connect in our minds. This makes it almost impossible for us as a nation to engage in long-range planning. Lesson 30. Who did it? Text A. Inspector Chester of Scotland Yard soon arrived on the scene of the crime. When the newspaper men saw him getting out of the car, they immediately realized that matters were serious. Inspector Chester had a fine reputation. He had solved many difficult and complicated crimes during the last few years. Most of them were robberies. This one concerned the theft of jewels belonging to a famous film actress. She was reputed to be a millionaireess, so it was not surprising that the missing jewels were valued at £250,000. The newspaper men were eager to question the detective. He stood on the pavement outside the house and smiled at the photographers. "Have you a statement to make?" somebody asked. The detective, tall, thick-set, middle-aged, clean-shaven, pushed his way through the crowd, climbed a few steps to the front door, turned round and said in a cool, clear voice, "I have no statement to make. As soon as there is anything fresh to tell you, I'll let you know." He beckoned to a policeman, whispered a few words in his ear and went into the house. After a "Move along, please," from the policeman, the crowd gradually dispersed. Upstairs, Inspector Chester walked over to the French windows. It was probably through these that the thieves had come. They had left no clues, no fingerprints. It had apparently not been difficult for them to break into the safe. Just as the detective was about to examine this once again, the telephone rang. "Hello, Inspector," a soft, monotonous voice said. "If you want a clue, why don't you talk to the servant, the one with a small scar on the right cheek?" Was this a trick? Would it put the inspector on the right track? Text B. Inspector Robinson was swearing aloud when he arrived at the fine old house at the top of the hill. The past few weeks had been rough for him, and it looked as if there was more trouble ahead. It was raining hard, and Carruthers, his assistant, who was waiting for him at the gate, was wet to the skin. As they walked up the path together, Carruthers explained what had happened. The woman, Sylvia Fortagna, a daughter of Lord Arthrington, had been found dead in the sitting room by one of the servants that evening. The police doctor, who had examined the body, was sure that it was a clear case of poisoning. They had not moved the body. It still lay face upwards, where it had fallen. Underneath her body, they had found the photograph of an unknown young man. There had been no signs of a struggle. The woman's husband had not been seen since lunchtime. According to the cook, he had left the house in anger, as she put it, after a quarrel with his wife, and had gone for a ride on one of his favourite horses. Carruthers pushed open the front door, and the two men entered the hall. Inspector Robinson took off his hat and went into the sitting room. "We'll have to wait," said Carruthers, wiping his glasses. "It's no use waiting," said the inspector. "I don't think he'll dare to come back. It's pretty obvious he did it." Saying this, he put on his hat. They were about to leave the house when they saw a dark figure approaching them from out of the shadows. It was Nigel Fortagna. Nigel Fortagna's story. "Yes, it's true that I knew that my wife was in love with another man, but I trusted her and believed that she would forget about him sooner or later. But when she returned from a weekend in Paris this morning, she told me that she wanted a divorce and threatened to do something terrible if I didn't agree to it. I refused, of course. She drank heavily at lunchtime and even opened the bottle which she had brought as a present for me. She insisted that I should join her for a drink, but I didn't because I had taken my medicine. I'm not supposed to take it with alcohol. I suffer from a weak heart, you see. She was in a terrible state, so I put some of my pills into my glass when she wasn't looking. Then I exchanged the glasses. It was not really much, but of course I should have known how dangerous these pills can be. But at that moment I was so angry that I didn't care. I was sick and tired of the argument and left the house. She was so drunk that she wouldn't have noticed any difference in the taste of the sherry. I came back to see how she was, and, besides, there's no point in running away, because life doesn't mean anything to me without her. James Highsmith's story. Afterwards, James Highsmith, the young man in the photograph, was questioned by Inspector Robinson. When he was told what had happened, he broke down.
"Yes, I'm not ashamed to admit that we were in love. We had a wonderful time in Paris, but I was afraid of losing her. Sylvia often talked about killing him because he would never agree to a divorce. I begged her not to do it, but she said that one of us had to. Then I found one of his prescriptions in her handbag. I bought the medicine, put some of it into a bottle of sherry, and told Sylvia to give it to him as a present. It was him or me. I wasn't anxious about her drinking from the bottle because I was fairly sure that it wasn't really enough to kill a normal, healthy grown-up.
I must have killed her, though, and the only comfort I can find in her death is that I don't have to share her with him any longer." Sylvia Fontana's story. James Highsmith did not know that the police had found a message on a slip of paper in Sylvia Fontana's handbag. "Dear James, please forgive me for the terrible thing I'm going to do, but it's the only way out. I have considered everything carefully, and I know it's very selfish. But W has destroyed my life and made me thoroughly unhappy. When you receive this letter, he will have been found dead after a heart attack with a glass of sherry in his hand. I tried to phone you earlier this morning, but couldn't reach you. In case they examine the body, they will think that he took an overdose of his medicine by mistake. His family will come over to comfort me and will probably stay for a few weeks, so please, don't try to get in touch. It will all be worth it in the end. All my love, yours ever, S." Additional information, crime and punishment. From the court notes of a local reporter. "In court, at 9 o'clock, apart from me, there are a few old ladies who have come to sit in the warm and a class of 14 to 15-year-olds with their teacher. 9:05. Court starts. First case. Henry P., 47, divorced, charged with being drunk. He refused to leave a pub at closing time and caused a bit of damage when the police tried to arrest him. P. said he had had an argument with his boss and could not face going home to an empty flat. 9:20. Mrs. F., 72, shoplifting. Apparently, Mrs. F. had stolen a frozen chicken, which she had hidden under her hat. At this, the schoolchildren burst out laughing, and even the magistrates have difficulty keeping a straight face. The chicken was so cold that she fell unconscious, otherwise she would probably not have been caught. Mrs. F., in tears, says she had not eaten meat for 3 weeks. It turns out that, although she has the old age pension, she does not know about other forms of support. 9:40. James S., 42, a teacher, charged with beating his wife and 2 young children. Mrs. S. is in hospital in bad shape. The mother-in-law is taking care of the children. The neighbors sent for the police. One case, thank heavens, where neighbors did not mind their own business. Mrs. S. had already run away twice, but S. had promised to change, and she had gone home again. S. said that he was ashamed of what he had done, but that he often lost his temper with his wife, who was quarrelsome and had no sense of duty. The school children looked thoughtful. They probably thought that teachers do not do that sort of thing. 10:30. Peter D., 19. D. stole, or rather borrowed, a motorcycle, intending, he said, to give it back to the owner after trying it out. D.'s father is at sea, and the mother is left to bring up 4 children, of whom Peter is the eldest, by herself. 11. Mrs. A., 45, A doctor's wife, president of a local ladies' club, was caught leaving a fashion shop wearing two dresses, only one of which belonged to her. Admitting that she had wanted to steal the dress, she could not explain why.
听力课堂，欢迎你！
听力课堂，欢迎你！听啊，讲啊。